Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are going to discuss the season three episode, episode 23, Wet Wired.
Yeehaw!
This is a fantastic episode, Jen. I feel like we've been wanting to talk about this one for a really long time. It just kind of worked now because we've been releasing a lot of season three episodes, and we also are sort of around this time in our mythology series. And so we thought, let's just do it. Let's just do it now.
Let's do it. I'm happy to.
But before we get to that, let's hear our tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our two-parter, our most recent addition to our mythology series, to Letha Kumi and Heron Volk. And we were joined for both of those episodes by the awesome Keith Ulick. Thank you, Keith. And we got some great responses to those. So thank you very much for everyone for tweeting. Jessica said, hooray, Keith is back, right? The interrogation scene is also one of my favorites, and The Brothers Karamazov is my favorite book. Oh, awesome. The Grand Inquisitor chapter and the Rebellion one before it are superb renderings of the nature and problem of evil. Evil isn't always loud and obvious. It can hide in plain, calm, seemingly rational sight and be very convincing that it is, in fact, good. Think The Smoking Man's Defense of His Actions or Reverend Mackey in Signs and Wonders. Evil's allurements are perfect fodder for a show based on the nature of belief. Go X-Files Diaries for going deep. And thanks, Annie and Jen, for continuing to provide X-Files-based listening in this mess of a time. Going to listen to this podcast ep again. Thank you, Jessica, for those great insights.
Yeah.
I think when we were doing the podcast, we realized none of the three of us had actually read The Brothers Karamazov, and so we weren't really in a position to speak at all authoritatively on that rather significant reference in the episode in To Letha Kumi. So thank you, Jessica, for bringing that to us and for kind of explaining that whole kind of that was very deep, the whole sort of nature of evil stuff. So that was very cool and very, very interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
And really, I mean, like, that's an ongoing theme in terms of CSM and CSM thinking that he's right when, in fact, we know he's actually kind of evil. So this is very interesting to see that reflected in, I mean, it's kind of a very sort of universal theme throughout literature. So very cool to see how exactly it worked in this case. So that's very interesting.
And like
I appreciate that.
Like you said, I mean, it carries all the way through to the revival, even with Smoking Man's. What would that have been? My Struggle 3, your favorite episode. His little intro, you know, the idea that, like, you know, I haven't always done everything that they would agree with. But in the end, I hope that to prove that I am right. I hope they know that I'm right.
Exactly.
And
good
that what you do is right, even if it could be evil, believing that it's right makes it justifiable in your mind. That's interesting.
Nice. Excellent. Very good reference. Emily Page says, I love the jail interrogation scene more the older I get. And I actually think you can't kill their love, which is what makes them who they are, is one of the most important lines of the series that we don't remember a lot. Great point, Emily. I tended to kind of forget that line, and it really stood out to me when we were going back and talking about these episodes again, because I mean, I love any kind of reference to love and truth and all of those wonderful things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this could be love in any sense, and, you know, kind of a universal love of humanity, or in a more romantic love sense. I think it's a reference to sort of the love that humans have, I think, in this particular context. But it could also just as easily apply to Mulder and Scully, because, you know, as we've talked about before, their love is like their power, essentially. It's the great power that binds them and the power that it has throughout the universe of the show. So that's a really great point, Emily, for bringing that quote to back to our attention and to give us a chance to talk about it again.
Yeah, definitely. It keeps Mulder and Scully point. It keeps them fighting and keeps them searching. So that's also very important. So
I love it. I love this idea that is also an ongoing theme throughout the X-Files, that love is this great power.
And it's driving force.
this driving force, and that it is what can save the world in the end, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
Pekka said, you guys make a good trio. Thank you. This was a super insightful episode. Finally learned what was so special in that stiletto, why it's more than just a pointy stick. Bothered me for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
Well, me too, Pekka. I think that the theory that Keith had was that it was magnetite.
Yeah, which makes so much sense.
Which makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like Keith probably has a special connection with magnetite. Having been a part of that wonderful moment of what the fuck is magnetite.
Any opportunity to bring that up is always worthwhile.
Always worthwhile. And I think it really works in this case, actually. So, yeah, Keith bringing the awesome headcanon there. So that was great.
Love it.
Isidub said, love the discussion and new insights brought by Keith. I never before thought about CSM's lung cancer and its possible healing by Jeremiah, one of them. Wow, I have to rewatch the episode. I love that when people feel like they want to rewatch the episode after hearing our podcast. I want to rewatch the episode many times after our podcast too. Because even though I've watched it usually a couple of times in preparation for our conversation, something interesting will come out of our conversation, yours and mine, or with Keith in this case.
Yeah, particularly with Keith, I was going to say.
Yeah. Keith brings a lot of really interesting angles to things, which is great.
Yeah.
Kathy G said, another great discussion. Interesting but not surprising that the two episodes offering continuity regarding Tina's stroke were written by Vince Gilligan. The deleted scene from Unruhe and the scene in Paper Hearts when she tells Mulder her memory isn't as good since the stroke. That's a really great point from Kathy G. I like that. You know that I have a lot of love in my heart for Vince Gilligan.
Mm-hmm.
And so great point that he was the one that was writing the episodes that picked up on that continuity that we were quite excited to discuss in our discussion of Herrenvolk, I think. So
yeah,
I appreciate that. Any chance to kind of like give a shout out to Vince, like, yes, Vince always in there with the sort of really following the characters' journeys really effectively and taking the care with that.
Yeah.
So
I feel like that happens too with some of the other writers in terms of things that they carry from episode to episode continuity wise that might not pick up with other writers. I'm trying to think of an example.
Yeah.
Like
Darren Morgan, I think, is
Queequeg is a good example. I mean, it's an easy one, but just the fact that like we don't really see Queequeg in anything unless Darren's involved.
Yes.
It's like almost like his own little world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like the king of continuity. Plus he wrote, and this isn't within the Darren universe, but he wrote, of course, The Lost Art of Forward Sweat, which we discussed not too long ago, I think, the aspect of, we're going to talk about it tonight. Mulder's colorblindness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Red-green colorblind.
Stay tuned,
which
folks.
Which comes up
in,
it appears to come up again in Lost Art of Forward Sweat. So that's a gold medal for continuity to Darren Morgan for that.
And so many years later.
And it wasn't even an episode that he wrote.
And I can't even, like, I don't know if you picked up on that. I can't take credit for that. And I wish I remember who drew this to my attention on Twitter, that was actually a
red-green. The red-green colorblind thing?
But I don't want to talk about it too much because we bring it up later.
It might be Kathy because, you know, Kathy's often on top of this kind of thing. But you know what? If it's you and you're listening to this, by all means, stick up your hand on Twitter and say, yep, that was me. I was that intelligent person.
It was a great catch.
It's like an awesome theory and to the point where I accept it as fact. So, and it makes me like both of those episodes even more than I already do, both Wet Wired and Lost Art of Forehead Sweat. From Ray Noel, thanks for inviting Keith. I can't believe after all these years, I finally get what it's all about with the arm cutting in Tunguska, because we kind of had a little sort of side discussion about that, which was great. So thank you very much. And just a shout out to Jen, because I seem to share her POV almost 100% on Herrenvolk. Thanks, Ray Noel, because that makes me feel like I actually had something to contribute and that I actually had a point of view, which I'm not totally sure that I did in retrospect, because sometimes we do these recordings and I think back and think, I don't remember what I actually said anything.
I don't remember either of our points of view.
I'm just really happy that it made sense to Ray Noel and that it rang true. So thank you for that. Thank you for legitimizing my argument, whatever it might have been.
The only point
that.
Of view that I will ever remember is your point of view on Bad Blood. That's literally the only one I'll ever remember.
That's the most embarrassing one.
We don't need to revisit it, but it's just so funny when I think about some of the things that we must have talked about on episodes, and I'm like, I wish I remembered. I do.
I know. Sometimes, I mean, I'm often going back, and I do the editing, and so I'm listening back to the episode, and I'm like, I have like no recollection of saying this. I don't even have a recollection of thinking it, let alone saying it. It's like it's one of those things you just kind of get into it, and. When you're doing a podcast, it's a little different from having just a regular conversation because it is a conversation, but you have to be thinking about a lot of other things at the same time.
Right.
Because you got to think about how much time do we have left? Yeah. You know, have we covered the topics we wanted to cover? Have I just said something incredibly stupid that I need to make a note of to go back and change in editing? Things like that. And so it's easy to kind of lose track of what you're actually saying sometimes.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's always kind of like, it's always fun to hear it again because it's like, well, wasn't that a funny thing that we said? Sometimes I'm listening to my own podcast going, which is really weird.
Same thing. Especially because a lot of the time we have recorded these many, many weeks and months prior to when they come out or when we're editing them. And so we really do forget. We do forget. So I don't know. If Ray Noel wants to be more specific, we would appreciate that. But there you go.
What did I say? So I'm just happy. I'm happy that it made sense to someone.
Well, I'm happy that you're happy, Jen.
We're all happy. So, and I hope that our Twitter followers are happy too. We love hearing from everyone, whatever their opinion about what they have to say or what we have to say. At any time, please tweet at us at XFD Podcast. And we look forward to seeing you on Twitter.
Older, the internet is not good for you.
I had something I wanted to chat with you about, Jen, before we get into this episode. And some of our longtime listeners might find this interesting. And if you don't, just, you know, fast forward a couple minutes. But Jen,
it's interesting anyway.
It really is. And it is on the X-Files.
It is interesting, honest.
It's in the family, right?
Yeah.
Jen, who I have been raving to about Breaking Bad for years now at this point. Finally sat down and watched it.
Yes.
How did you like it, and how long did it take you to binge that, Jen?
All right. I loved it. Yes. Like, loved it.
Yes.
It's fucking brilliant.
It really is.
It's genius. Mm-hmm. It's like a genius television show, and I don't use that term very often. I mean, you've told me. Mm-hmm. It's nothing new to anyone that's seen it, but somehow to me it was. It's a brilliant work of art, and I watched like one episode a day pretty much because I didn't want to, I knew that it was released once a week when it was originally aired, and I didn't want to binge it too fast because I wanted to have time for each episode to sink in a bit because there's always a lot happening in each episode. And so I was doing one a day, some occasionally two a day, depending on how bored I was, but for the most part, once a day. And so however many episodes that is approximately how many days it took me to binge it.
I mean, that's quick and that is consistent. And I like that. Like, I watched this show live. And so, we had to wait a week every single time. And episode is like a crazy cliffhanger, right?
I tried to be quite disciplined and not watch the next episode right away. There was only one time, and I won't say when it was, that I thought, there's no way I am not at least watching the start of the next episode.
Yeah.
Because I can. Uh-huh. Unlike the poor people. See, I'm in the position now that the new X-File fans are in, which is that new X-File fans can just blow through the seasons if they so choose. Whereas I was like yourself back in the day watching the X-Files, having to wait several months between the cliffhanger at the end of Anasazi, for example, before Blessing Wave was aired. So I'm kind of appreciating what it's like to come to a show after the fact, what it's like to watch it differently and to have that option. And it's been really, really interesting. I mean, it's funny because, I mean, there's not like a lot of Breaking Bad discourse out there at the moment.
There really isn't.
which is kind of nice, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice just to feel like this is my own little thing that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I've talked to you a lot about it, and other than that, it's just like just me sitting there watching Breaking Bad, and I feel like I'm discovering it. It's like it's all mine.
Yeah.
And it's been like a lot of fun and really interesting. And the rare days when I didn't get to watch an episode, I was really missing it. So it's been really quite a journey, I have to say.
I love that. And I've been looking forward, or had been looking forward to getting your texts. Like it would literally be a text that would be just like, what the fuck? What the fuck, Walter White, was a very, very recurring theme and very understandable. But
it was very cathartic for me to be able to text you at the end and say why.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was helpful. So thank you for that. And thank you for recommending Breaking Bad to me as many times as you did.
Oh, my God.
And for being just sticking with it and trying repeatedly, because I was like, yeah, sure,
you're
whatever.
Like, I'll get to it someday. I'll get to it someday.
Yeah.
And now your life will never be the same, right? It's true.
It won't. And because I thought, you know, it's like five seasons. And I was like, that's a lot. I don't feel like taking on that challenge. You know, 8 episodes of a show is like all I'm in the mood for usually.
Right.
But
it's a commitment.
Once I got rolling.
Yeah.
It was great, because you know what? I was relieved of the hassle of trying to figure out what to watch next.
Mm-hmm.
It was just Breaking Bad nonstop for like a couple months, which was so fun.
It's really fun to just immerse
yourself.
It was
a magical time.
Yeah. Oh, good.
It was like, you know, I will look back on the summer of 2021 and be like, oh, that was my Breaking Bad summer. Nice.
I love
that. That was awesome. I would occasionally text you from my basement, because we've had a lot of heat here in Western Canada, as in many places around the world. And so the only place that was cool enough to sort of like survive was our basement. And so I'd be down there. It's sitting in our laundry room. It's an unfinished basement, watching Breaking Bad. And so that's how I will remember the summer of 2021. It was
nice.
Good times.
I love that I can now make Breaking Bad references and you'll know what I'm talking about. That's my favorite thing.
I will be all over that.
And
totally.
It's funny that we're recording this particular episode today, because akin to this conversation might come up later, actually, in tonight's discussion.
I look forward to it.
And I am drinking a Shiner Bock in honor of Vince Gilligan. Because you finally finished Breaking Bad. So cheers to that. Cheers to you, Jen, for finishing Breaking Bad, and to
Thanks.
Vince Gilligan for making an amazing show and being an amazing writer on The X-Files. You know what? We've
Vince
come full
Gilligan.
Circle.
He's so great. Vince Gilligan is like the man. I mean, I was inclined to think a couple of times watching Breaking Bad, I'm like, he's perhaps learning from his time on The X-Files and mm-hmm. doing it differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to say there's anything wrong with the X-Files, but maybe there was a few, he decided to take things in a different direction in terms of how the show was structured. And I think that he made some very wise decisions.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually gone on record saying that he learned from mistakes on the X-Files and that mm-hmm. he didn't want to repeat them on Breaking Bad, which I think was cool of him to say.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But at the same time, he's really good about the X-Files, too.
Yeah.
Like, he still seems to really appreciate it. And
oh, yeah. No, I don't mean that in, like, a derogatory way. I think
no,
in
absolutely.
Just a growing way, like, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Vince Gilligan became a really big deal, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Mr., you know, Emmy's this and that and that. And it would be very easy for him to be like, oh, the X-Files, that was, like, the old days when I was a nobody and that really doesn't matter to me anymore. But no, he's still very gracious about
yeah.
his time on the X-Files, which he doesn't have to be because he's a really big deal now.
Yeah.
And I think that's nice. And I think and the folks on the X-Files are really gracious about him too, which is nice. They obviously all still have a good relationship. So that's very cool. It makes me happy in my heart. And yeah, for sure. Obviously you're a fan of the X-Files. If you're listening to us, you'll definitely feel a bit X-Filesy from time to time watching Breaking Bad. And if you're a fan of Vince Gilligan's episodes, which I definitely am, and I think most people probably are, then you just get like, you know, wall to wall Vince Gilligan vibe
yeah.
for 5 seasons. Like, what could be better?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Jen, congrats, and I'm so happy for you. And
thank you.
I'm sure many of our listeners are too. So
yeah, this is a happy time of my life.
Love it.
Nice.
All right, Jen. So Wet Wired. The writer is Matt Beck, who you said that you did a little bit of background research on, and the director is Rob Bowman, who we are very familiar with. But tell us a little bit about Matt Beck.
All right. I was curious about Matt Beck because I love Wet Wired, as we'll be discussing extensively today. And I was like, Wet Wired? Who did write Wet Wired? I can't remember. It was one of my faves, I'm sure. And then I checked and I'm like, Matt Beck? Who's that?
Yeah.
And so I had to kind of, he only wrote one episode of The X-Files. And I thought, okay, maybe he went on to bigger and better things. He's obviously a very talented writer. No, this is the only episode of television he's ever written. He's a visual effects guy. He was the visual effects supervisor on The X-Files.
Nice.
From seasons 1 to 3 and seasons 8 and 9 and also I Want to Believe. He also did visual effects on other Chris Carter shows like Harsh Realm and The Lone Gunman. And he also sort of in that break when he wasn't doing The X-Files for a few seasons, he was off doing things like being a visual effects supervisor on movies like Titanic. So the guy is like very majorly sort of talented and well-recognized in the industry and has gone on to do a bunch of, you know, wonderful visual effects on lots of different shows and movies. So he's obviously well-known in that role. But for whatever reason, he decided to write an episode of The X-Files. His is the only writing credit as well. So it's not like, oh, well, you know, our friend Matt wanted to pretend to write an episode of The X-Files and then we fixed it for him.
There's no co-writer
like Matt Beck and, you know, Chris Carter, or Matt Beck and Vince Gilligan or something like that. His is the only writing credit, which is not to say it wasn't, you know, helped along with other writers, but not enough to give them a credit.
Right.
According to Wikipedia, Wikipedia says Beck was inspired to pen the episode after hearing the debates concerning violence on television and its effect on viewers. So apparently that was the sort of the source of his inspiration. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that subject as we go along. But that's Matt Beck, which I did not know any of that about Matt Beck until I IMDb'd him a couple of days ago. And I was like, oh, he's not even a writer. And yet he wrote this amazing episode of The X-Files.
Yeah, I remember having a similar experience. Like, it wasn't for this, but I feel like the last time I watched this, I had the same thought. Like, oh, I wonder, is this a Vince episode? Like, I couldn't remember. And then I looked and I had the same thought. Like, oh, I don't really know who that is, but well done you, you know, because this is another favorite of mine. So that's really cool, though. I mean, he did a really great job. I mean, they did a lot of these people who just kind of were one and done. There were some stinkers, but we won't name any. But there were also some really good ones like this. Okay, well, where did you go after this? Like, I remember another one. I mean, I feel like Jeffrey Bell only wrote like two. Right. And he was another one that wrote really good episode. He wrote Rain King, I believe. And then what was the other one? Signs and Wonders, I think.
I want to say Goldberg Variation.
Oh, he wrote Goldberg Variation?
I think so.
Okay, wait.
All right.
You're probably right. I just want to double check because now I feel like I said totally the wrong thing. But
that's okay. No. That's what we have the internet for.
Yeah. Yeah,
the internet is our friend.
It is Goldberg, but he also wrote Signs and Wonders, so we were both
right. Oh, he did what? All right, we were both right.
Look at that. So he wrote three. But anyway.
Those are, you know, major episodes.
Yeah, that was a bad example because he wrote three. But still, out of 200, it's a minimal amount.
Yeah, that's not, considering, you know, the impact he made. It's, and a lot of the times, and certainly we see this in the revival, it's folks that are like connected with the series in some fashion.
Right.
Usually, you know, as like a, you know, a script supervisor or something, and then they come in and like, boom, here's their episode. But I wouldn't have seen it coming from a visual effects supervisor. Mm-mm. But somewhere along the way, he had this episode in him, and this was it. He had something to say. He said it and moved on with his visual effects career.
Yep. I love it. And I mean, made an impact, like you said. So let's get into this, Jen. The cool thing I think about Wet Wired, and I feel like we've maybe brought this up before, is that it's one of the very rare episodes that sort of combines Monster of the Week with the mythology. And this happens periodically and in like small ways, like, okay, Leonard Betts, we have the whole thing as a Monster of the Week. And then at the very end, we have an important mythology, you know, point of plot. Whereas this feels like And I wanted to ask your opinion on this because we're going to talk about the conspiracy overall, like the purpose of this, who was behind it, all of that. Was it important, do you think, for this to be a mythology episode? Or do you think this could have been less mythology oriented? And I mean, I don't even think it was a lot. We kind of needed Smoking Man, like we needed some of this stuff. But I feel like it was a little bit too much stuff thrown at me in this episode. I mean, that would be my one criticism of Wet Wire, that I think it's overcomplicating things. So what's your take on that?
Fair point. I didn't feel that way personally. I kind of love the fact that everybody is in this episode.
No, I love that too. I just mean in terms of the conspiracy and like it being clearly something I think that we're meant to think is syndicate driven. Right? Because the Smoking Man's behind it all. And then we never hear about this ever again. Like, and that's what I mean. It feels like an unnecessary red herring. That's, you know, like.
It's odd. It's a very unusual episode in the X-Files arc because it has all the makings of a mythology episode when you just watch it. You know, all the mythology characters are there. There is obvious implications that the syndicate is behind a conspiracy, this particular one. It's a very specific conspiracy that we've never heard of before and we never hear of again.
Right.
So was this intended to have a long-term consequence? I'm not inclined to think so. It doesn't seem there's no attempt to connect it with the actual mythology. I mean, I'm not sure we can call this a mythology episode because it doesn't actually fit in with the X-Files mythology.
Right. And it doesn't. I don't think that's the intent either. So like I agree what you're saying. It almost seems like it's. And when I say red herring, I don't think it's meant to deliberately confuse people, but it's just another little grain of rice on top of this huge mountain of that we're already trying to figure out, you know, and they throw this in and it's like, OK, wait, so where does this fit in? When the reality is this really doesn't fit in. It's just sort of trying to tell you that these guys have got their hands in everything. Like we're talking about this ball here that we're juggling. But meanwhile, there's like 18 other ones going on around us. That's how I feel about this. So it doesn't really bother me, but I do feel like it was sort of at points unnecessarily confusing.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I was starting to get a little bit troubled by the mythology at this stage of watching the X-Files. But weirdly enough, this episode didn't trouble me in the least. I don't know why. I mean,
do you mean confused or do you mean? Oh, okay.
Or, you know, troubled as in like basically every other mythology episode made me be like, pull me out. Why is this happening? Why are we just adding more confusing things? I don't like this.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
Whereas I didn't feel that way about Wet Wired for whatever reason. I didn't think to connect it really with the larger mythology, even though there's a lot of reasons that I could have, but there's no obvious connection with the greater story. And for whatever reason, it didn't occur to me to think of it as a mythology episode. Perhaps it's just simply because of its position in the season.
Right.
That it wasn't part of a two-parter. It wasn't going to be like during sweeps month or something. Obviously, there was a two-parter coming up that we knew about and right after this. And so I think I was already in the mode of thinking this was going to be a one-off. And for some reason, all the sort of mythology elements didn't throw me off in the least. So I was just kind of like, oh, this is a happy surprise. And I tend to forget about them, quite frankly, when I look back and think about Wet Wire. Sometimes I completely forget that Mr. X was in that episode at all.
Yeah.
So I tend to just remember, you know, some aspects of the episode, and some I'm like, was CSM actually in that episode, or did Scully just imagine him? I can't quite remember. And so it doesn't feel very mythology-esque when you're watching it, because to me, the usual parties like CSM don't appear to be driving the action until the end, really, where we find out, yes, he was.
Yeah.
But for most of the episode, there's not that same sense at all. And it feels, I love it. I mean, I love it the same way I love EBE, in the sense that it does have kind of it's a one-off sort of mythology type episode, EBE more so. But I tend to really love these one-off episodes that aren't really a monster of the week. There's no monster here, but it's you know, but it's a one-off. I really like those kind of episodes that are one-offs. They're not strictly mythology. There's no monster. It is a conspiracy-centered episode, but it's not part of the larger mythology. I actually really love those kind of episodes, and it's one of the reasons I love Wet Wire.
Yeah, and I mean, I can completely, that's the way I see it too, so I agree with you completely. It's just, you know, I mean, I already sort of said what I mean. I just...
That's okay. You have a very valid point of view.
It's, yeah, I don't know. It's a lot. There's a lot in this episode.
There's a lot.
And I think, other than that, I feel like my other main issue, and right off the top, we're talking about issues. Overall, I love this episode. But another thing that I kind of take issue with in this episode is just the fact that, like, the climax, in my estimation...
Yeah.
Happens like two-thirds of the way through the episode, and then it just kind of fizzles out after that. And it's unfortunate, because I think everything that happens after that is important stuff and great stuff. It just doesn't have the same impact, and I think David and Jillian are to blame, quote-unquote, thank for that, because the scene in the house, we'll get to it later, is so powerful. That's what you remember. And then everything after that is just him kind of sort of figuring it out, and Scully's like left alone in a hospital bed. And it's like, I feel like, I don't know how they could have rewritten or rearranged these events to make that climax take place closer to the end of the episode. But every time I watch it, which is a lot because I love this episode, I wish that climax was closer to the end, because I just kind of want to turn it off after that. Like, and I can't, because there's still like 10 more minutes of show. So
I was, that's exactly how I felt. I've never really noticed that structure before until I was rewatching it this week. Usually I just watch Wet Wired and let it all the beauty wash over me. But since I was sort of paying a little more sort of strict attention, I was like, oh, yay, happy times. I think I'm done. And then I'm like, wait a second. There's 10 minutes left.
Yeah.
I agree that it would have been, it's a tricky episode in terms of balance, because there's so much tremendous character stuff with Mulder and Scully. And again, yeah, I agree with you that David and Jillian are largely to blame for that, for their fantastic performances.
Yeah.
And so they take it to another level that I'm not sure was on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, the important mythology stuff that honestly, I'm not sure I really care that much after that. But if they had included more of the mythology explanation before Scully's sort of story was resolved, to me, it would have seemed kind of like, what are you doing, Mulder, going and seeing Mr. X and chasing all these things? You should be looking for Scully.
Yeah. So
and
I
that
get
would have
it.
Annoyed me probably.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it. There really probably isn't another way they could have done it. But I just think pacing-wise and for story beats, it's slightly off for me in that.
I agree.
But, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. That is, it just worked out that way to a certain extent.
And in
some ways the stuff at the end feels a little tacked on, maybe. I wonder if that was rewritten to a certain extent. I wonder how much of that was in the original script. I'd be curious to see what the first draft was, whether that was meant to end sooner than it did, but they're like, let's ramp into Tully Thakumia, which is coming up next. And so let's throw in a little bit more mythology at the end, especially centered around Mr. X. So I'm not sure if that was tacked on, perhaps, you know, at some point in the in the script writing process.
It's possible.
But it is what it is. It's certainly by no means a fatal flaw.
No, not at all. It's just something that sticks out to me when I watch it.
But I agree.
What you said before, I mean, like, what I love about this episode, too, is just like you said, everybody's in it. We have CSM, we have X, we have the gunman, we have Skinner.
Yeah. Even we got Maggie Scully.
Yes, Maggie Scully. Even Pendril and Danny get mentions. Like, I feel like the whole gang is
they
here.
They do, both of them.
They both do.
Yeah, honestly, right?
The only one we're missing is Krycek. I mean, we don't have Krycek, but, you know,
Oh, that's okay. I'm fine.
We're fine with that. I guess we're fine with that. But I did want to give...
It was exciting.
I wanted to give Rob Bowman a shout out because the direction in this episode is really great.
It is.
I mean, in everything, the performances too are amazing. But like, there's some of the shots in this are really interesting. Just it's a very visually pleasing episode. I think it's just nice to watch.
Is.
Yeah,
That's a great point. It is a very visually pleasing episode. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the reasons why I enjoy rewatching it so much.
Yeah.
And I find Rob Bowman's particular visual style, I think, is probably my favorite of the X-File directors. As soon as when I was watching the cold open this week, I couldn't remember who the director was. But as soon as we saw sort of it's a woodsy scene, it's at night, there's this amazing light and it's a little bit foggy, I'm like, this looks very Rob Bowman. And it totally was. So he's got that amazing style. And he did like a couple of really cool things throughout the episode that just work to enhance the episode. They're not show offy by any means. They just work really well to make it a very, as you say, visually pleasing. And it really adds to the narrative. So
yeah.
Adoration for Rob Bowman and his directing.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good job. Good stuff. So this, we start out with Mulder waiting for, well, I mean, we have our cold open with this guy who's, now, I wanted to ask you this, Jen, because this guy is clearly, he's been exposed to the, you know, subliminal, I don't know the technical term.
Doodah.
Yeah.
Let's call it doodah.
Let's call it the doodah. Okay.
Yeah.
I did you just make
the subliminal doodah.
I like that.
To use the technical term.
Yes. And he is seeing something, like he's seeing this war criminal as everyone he sees. Like there's a visual thing happening to him. And then the same thing happens to the lady later who's washing the dishes, and then she's looking out the window and like she sees her husband with a woman when it was really just a dog or whatever. So there's something going on with like visual, like their eyes are actually being affected. I'm guessing it could also have to just do with their brain sending them signals that aren't true, which is probably what's happening. But that isn't what seemed to be happening to Scully. Like it wasn't like she was seeing things. You know what I mean? And so it felt like a different thing was happening to Scully, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe that she was still being affected mentally, just in a different way. Like they were being affected mentally, and it manifested like through their vision. And with hers, it was just in her brain. Like, I don't know, but it feels different.
I think that's, I mean, that's a great point, actually. I hadn't really thought about that, but I think perhaps there's a couple of different reasons for that. I think it's entirely possible that the other characters, who we only saw quite briefly, were sort of more affected other than just having like visual hallucinations. We saw the visual hallucinations because, you know, that's probably the quickest way to convey to the audience what's going on. But, you know, they may have been acting weird at various times. I don't really know, but there's no question that Scully seems more unhinged than the other ones.
She does see Smoking Man. So she is seeing something isn't there. That's true.
So she does. Yeah. She does have that one visual hallucination where she sees the Smoking Man, although she also has what appears to be an auditory hallucination when she thinks she's hearing Mulder through the motel room walls.
Yes.
You know, he may well have been talking to somebody, or he may not have been talking to anybody, and she just imagined that the voices. So she's obviously experiencing a lot of hallucinations and delusions.
Mm-hmm.
To use the psychological terminology,
yes,
hallucinations are like when you see and hear something that's not there. Delusions are when you believe something that's not true.
Yeah.
And she seems to be more driven by her delusions than her hallucinations. It's more about what she believes than what she sees. But it could be because we know Scully so well that we know when she's acting weird.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, clearly she's acting weird. I was just wondering in terms of the differences that this device affects different people. Mm. But, you know,
there's every reason to think that it would affect people differently because everything does, right? You know, my meds may not work the same for somebody else. That's, you know, it's notoriously difficult to get psychopharmaceutical meds to work properly because everything works differently for different people. So it's probably the same thing with this.
Yeah. And that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, here we have Mulder, though, waiting without Scully, of course.
Well, yeah, of course.
I mean,
Doing his thing
where he, I mean, maybe it's like middle of the night. He doesn't want to. I feel like a lot of the time when Mulder, quote unquote, ditches Scully or he's going to meet contact without her or whatever, I feel like this is almost like a vetting process for him. Like I want to believe that he's not intending to keep any of this from her. He's just kind of like, eh, she's sleeping.
Right.
I'll tell her later. Like, because a lot of the time it's almost like, okay. And maybe there's a protective aspect too. Like, she doesn't need to be here. There's no need for her to put herself into possible danger. So I could just do this on my own and then tell her about it later. It always rides the line for me between being kind of sweet and sort of overly protective. Like, I don't really know. Yeah. I don't know how to feel about it.
I think for me, it's kind of, I get the feeling that Mulder does a lot of sort of hobby type conspiracy stuff, yeah, like, in his own time.
This is his overtime. Scully's sleeping.
This is his overtime. And he knows it's probably, it is like he's talking about having waited almost 2 hours.
Right.
And so he knows that Scully is not going to be interested in that. And he's not going to, like, bug her. Right. He's going to save that for the better stuff. He'll, you know, he'll figure out whether this is worth bugging her about, yeah, or not. So I have a feeling he probably does a lot of kooky stuff that doesn't pan out.
Yeah.
And he thought, well, because it was just an anonymous email, right? So he had no clue what he was going to get from it. So he thought, you know, Scully will be very annoyed with me if I drag her along.
But he picks his battles.
Because I drag her along to enough things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm just going to go, like you say, I think it's more like a vetting thing where, yeah, I think he probably meets a lot of crazy people that nothing comes of it. So.
Yes. That's
he figured,
true,
you know, let's just see what happens. So it doesn't trouble me in any fashion. It just seems like that's just Mulder being Mulder, especially, you know, this is only season three. So we still get the vibe that the X-Files is his thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is him doing his thing,
right,
you know, 24/7. So that's how I took it.
Yeah, I didn't take it in a bad way either. I just always think it's funny every time that he's just kind of doing something without Scully. I always have to point it out. But I kind of liked this guy, this source. He was kind of cheeky with Mulder, and I thought he was kind of funny. He was he's like, well, how do I know you're telling me the truth? And he's like, you don't. Like, I just love how, like, zero shits he gave.
Whatever, and, dude.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just here delivering a message, bro. But, like, he was also pretty smart telling Mulder, like, appealing to Mulder's good nature about the fact that, like, if you don't do this, people are gonna die. Like, it's almost like X obviously tells him that because X knows what's gonna work with Mulder. Like, he knows that's Mulder's, you know, quote unquote weak spot. So I thought that was interesting. But, like, I don't know. I thought the whole scene in the car was kind of, it was a really well written scene. I liked it.
It was. I think he's referred to as plainclothes man in the script, as far as I know.
I mean, he's like that.
They were really at the bottom of the barrel for coming up with terms for him. Plainclothes man. He's wearing plain clothes, apparently.
Yes. Plain clothes.
So, yeah, plainclothes man. According to Wikipedia, again, who knows, shoulder shrug. The only reason we have plainclothes man is because Stephen Williams, who plays X, wasn't available for the entirety of this episode because he was off filming L.A. Heat, whatever that is. I have no recollection of L.A. Heat. Maybe our listeners do. And so they had to write in plainclothes man. Otherwise, it was meant to be Mr. X.
Okay,
that's what Wikipedia tells me.
That makes sense to me because I feel like this was just one more element that added to, like, the mountain of confusion.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, okay, why do we have this new character? I mean, no one will ever see him again, but why couldn't that have just been X? Why does it have to be a he said, she said kind of thing? Like, it was just like another added element that didn't feel necessary, but that makes sense. If they needed it because X wasn't available, then that makes sense. There was this scene, the next scene where they go down. They see Stroman is his name, the doctor.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Stroman.
I cannot watch this scene without thinking of the blooper. I know you've said this before, that you don't watch bloopers because you're terrified of this happening. But, like, this is one of those where I just remember the blooper where he's like, I came down from blah, 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 blah. And he cannot get the line out, like, two times. And Jillian is just cracking up over and over. And, like, they can't even start the scene because they just got into this laughing fit. I don't know. I always think of that blooper.
That is awesome.
I find it
distracting watching Dr. Stroman because I'm always trying to think where I've seen him before. And then I finally just looked it up.
Well, who is he?
He's been on the X-Files twice before.
Okay.
The one that's most familiar to me and probably to most people, he was in Endgame as the apparent survivor on the submarine when Mulder gets there, who turns out to be the alien bounty hunter.
Yeah.
He's all like, oh, terrible things happened.
Yeah.
So I remember him quite vividly from that. He also apparently played the fellow in 731, Escalante, the resident of the Hanson's facility, who, like, talks to Scully.
But he would have had all that makeup.
It's quite a prominent role, but he's, you know, got a lot of, you know, all that makeup and prosthetics and such. So
interesting.
He's not, and his voice is a bit different too. So I would never have put that together,
no.
But Thank you, IMDb. I did, and it was mostly Endgame that I remembered him from.
Yeah.
He's a handsome young man.
He does have one of those faces that, yeah, he is handsome. And I remember thinking that when I was watching it, like, oh, he looks so familiar. But I was also just like, maybe it's just because I've seen that blooper so many times. I don't know.
Yeah. Could be that, too.
Yeah. But yeah, he was good. I liked him, too, because he was... It was another unassuming character that came back later as sort of a bad guy. And you're like, oh, I wasn't seeing that coming.
Yeah, that's obviously like what they like to do with him on The X-Files, because it was kind of the same thing in Endgame, where it's kind of like this. He comes off as this kind of, you know, good guy, very much so. But then, turns out to be a bad guy. So, hey, it works.
Yeah.
It worked on me. I was duped by him just as Mulder and Scully were.
Yeah. So he tells them about kind of what happened with this guy. And so they go to his house. And I think this scene with the kids that just kind of broke into the house and they're like watching this violent movie. First of all, clearly Matt Beck is making a statement here. I liked the inclusion of the kids watching the violent movie. I mean, like they could have been watching anything, but it kind of harkens back to Scully, you know, or when Scully says like the effect that violence can have on, you know, what was it you mentioned that her something about her theory.
Scully's theory about, you know, violent television begets violent behavior, which I think is kind of her running theory at the beginning when they realize that there is obviously some connection with television here. I think it's a really weak theory, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And Mulder does quite a good job of debunking it and calls it pseudoscience. And we don't expect Scully to be talking pseudoscience, but honestly, it sounds kind of pseudoscience-y. She's quite adamant about it. And I'm trying to remember back in the 90s what kind of the theories were at that point. But, I mean, this was like a big deal back then. Less so now, I think. But back then, people were talking a lot about violence on television and the belief that it made people violent. But generally speaking, it was, like Mulder says, kind of a political thing.
Yeah.
And it was like these sort of, you know, groups of like outraged housewives that, you know, let's have less violence on television. So it doesn't seem quite right to me for Scully to be sort of on that side, but I suppose she doesn't have a whole lot else to go on and trying to form a theory, but it doesn't quite ring true. I feel like they could have done better in terms of coming up with a good theory for Scully.
Right. And I feel like she also does this a lot in terms of like, she's going to, you know, espouse some theories that she may not necessarily believe, but they are counterpoints to what Mulder is going to be thinking or suggesting. So I can kind of chalk this up to that.
True.
I don't necessarily think she believes everything that she's saying in terms of like, oh, it's possibly this, it's possibly this. I think she's just kind of saying, hey, this is possible. It's possible.
Yeah. There are studies kind of thing.
So I can kind of excuse it there. But I do love this scene because I just love Mulder with kids. I thought it was really...
Oh, my God.
He's so
Mulder
funny.
And Scully, too. She doesn't have as much to do in this scene, but it's still there. The two of them both are adorable with the kids.
Yeah. Mulder even kind of like ruffles one of the kids' hair, like, get out of here, God, you scamp. But I'm like, these two kids are, they're truants. Go send them to the principal's office. Yes, I was
adorable.
Just
the kids are great too, aren't they? I find them very entertaining.
Yeah, like I don't know, man. If I found out my kid like broke into some neighbor's house where someone had just been murdered and like went into their freezer and pulled out their ice cream and then just made themselves at home in front of their big screen TV, I would be like, you are going to be grounded for a very, very long time.
It's very disturbing when you think about it. I mean, sometimes I forget about which house is that. But yeah, it's a murder house. And they're just like, obviously, I get the impression they've done this before.
Yeah.
And they leave it open for the cat. So it's nothing necessarily to do with the fact that it's a murder house.
Yeah,
but
maybe they didn't even know. It's possible.
Maybe they didn't. But yeah, it is a murder house. And it's a crime scene, and probably like they're in there like putting their fingerprints all over the place. It's a terrible thing forensically.
Yeah,
I wonder if that's why they specifically wrote it so that they hadn't come through the front door, was so that they wouldn't see the crime tape. If they came through the window, then maybe you're right that they actually didn't know that
this
that
is
a crime
just
had
their
been committed.
Their routine, and
this
they,
is just what they do.
Yeah, they had no idea. Yeah. Probably they're probably spooked to see FBI agents there, which they were. So I mean, maybe we can forgive these kids.
Exactly,
they aren't necessarily dark and macabre. They're just truants.
Yeah, they're just truants. It's quite a delightful little scene.
Yeah, Yeah. It's cute. So I like the fact that they take all these tapes. Like, it's, yeah, it's such a leap. Like, right? Like,
right.
Like, this is the first thing you're going to do. Like, okay, we're like the lead FBI agents on this case. And we're going to be like, yeah, you know what? Let's take a shit ton of these VHSs home and just start watching them. Maybe there's a clue.
That's the clue we're taking from the host. We have this whole host full of probably potential clues all over the place.
Yeah.
But apparently what really stands out is the VHS collection, which, I mean, if you were like me back in the 90s, we all had VHS collections. I mean, well, I had my X-Files collection for sure.
Why are they doing it too? Like, don't they have some flunkies that could do this for them? Like, couldn't they hire the gunman and be like, hey, could y'all like watch these videos for us? Yeah. We have actual police work to do. Like, anyway, I get it. Yeah, I get honestly why they're doing it. But it's very strange. It's like, yeah, they're up all night watching tapes. And don't get me started on like Mulder coming in and being all cute and comfy in his white t-shirt. Oh, and Scully is still wearing her heels after having watched videos for hours.
Like, yeah, not only is she still wearing her suit.
Her suit
she's
and
wearing
her heels. Unforgivable. Like,
unforgivable.
It's bad enough when she's like hanging out in Mulder's apartment and she's still wearing her shoes like in the morning or something. Or like, you know, all the conspiracy theories of whenever she's over there late at night, but like she's got her shoes on. And I'm just like, nobody does that. Like, you go in, you get comfy, you take your shoes off. That's the first thing that it's just natural. It's
natural.
It's such a weird move. Like,
why? She's just sitting there, sitting upright in this chair.
Yes.
Wearing her suit and her heel.
You
well
cannot,
into the night, even after Mulder leaves, she's still doing this.
Yes. Yeah, you cannot tell me that she sat in that room for several hours and did not peel off those pantyhose. No woman in their right mind would have done that.
No way. That's the first thing to go right after the heels.
This is something and that women in the writer's room would have fixed. Just saying.
Yes, exactly. And like, she would have at least taken her jacket off. At least. I mean, Mulder's taken off his jacket, his tie, his shirt. Come on.
Yeah. And like, Mulder was allowed to get casual. So why can't Scully? What the hell, guys? You don't.
What the hell?
You know, you have gotten me started. So I was just about to say, don't get me started. But I have gotten started. I mean, we have already discussed Scully's season 9 mommy wear that I have a huge issue with. And I could tell that Jillian probably definitely knew better, but just was she was so checked out at that point that she's like, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it. I guarantee you. Yeah. She's like, it's not even worth it. But I'm just sitting here going, who is making these decisions? Who is making the decision for her to be walking around with her heels on in the motel room? Like, it's fine. Honestly, if you're gonna do it just like at the beginning, like you just walked into the motel room and you're having a conversation, sure, but she's been in there for hours
watching
videos.
TV.
Come on, get comfy, Scully. Like, no wonder everybody thinks you're a tight ass. Like, I hate stuff like this. It's so irritating.
Yeah, and it's not like it has anything at all to do with the plot. If there was some reason why she had to like run out the door or something like that, I could understand. But I mean, when she does eventually leave the room, she has plenty of time to put her shoes back on. So there's no reason to have those shoes on.
Right. And I mean, I feel like even at a certain point, like in these coming up scenes, when she's starting to like, you know, be affected and be getting paranoid and stuff, and like they could have had a scene where she's just kind of like putting on her shoes, kind of like, I'm getting kind of scared. I need to be ready. Like that could have been a
I like
thing.
That. Yeah. No, it's very, very, very strange. And I'll also add, and if we're talking about what's odd, is it always struck me as strange that they watch this all on fast forward. I understand because there's a ton of videos. I don't quite understand, and this is just strictly sort of we're getting into technical stuff.
Right.
I don't see how these like mystery doodads could have affected Scully when she's watching it all on fast forward.
I was going to ask the same thing. I mean, even Mulder, like when the gunmen later are trying to explain to him how television works, and it's like,
yeah,
I don't know how television works. I never really thought about it. I'm Mulder. Eh? You point the thing and it turns on, there's a light and blah, blah, blah.
That's like, great.
That's how, I mean, and that's a great line, by the way. I love that.
Yeah.
But like, you think that the way that these things work is that it's a particular timing of the flashing that has to be affecting you.
Yeah.
That, or at the very least, if they're going to say that we were fast forwarding through all those tapes, they should have explained, the gunman should have explained clearer later. Not that I understood any of that, but like they could have maybe said something that clued into the audience that, oh, that's why this affected Scully. It's just, you're right.
Yeah.
I bumped on it too. It seems like a huge sort of oopsie, and for no reason. Yeah. Like, they didn't have to be watching it, with fast forward. Like,
no, exactly. They would have been. I can understand that they would have been doing some fast forwarding, but I think to me it would have made sense if when we were watching Scully watching it, she was doing some fast forwarding and some watching at regular speed so that we got the sense. Maybe they had trouble getting, maybe they had an idea of something she'd be watching that they couldn't get clearance on later on or something. I don't know, but it doesn't make sense because we see TV being played in the background in other scenes, the game show, the shopping channel. For whatever reason, we're not allowed to see anything that Scully's watching unless it was like a CNN thing or something like that. But it would have just made sense for her to watch a little bit of it.
She found
then we could have got the idea.
She found some tapes of Red Shoe Diaries and she was watching those. And that's why suddenly she was terrified of Mulder. Did that land? No.
No, absolutely. I like it. I embrace it as a theory.
And she was just watching it for fun. And then Mulder came in and she was like, yep, I've been doing all of my work. I watched all these tapes when really she didn't.
I've been working very hard here watching these tapes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. In the dark.
Yep. As you should. As you should. Yeah. No, actually don't watch it. It's terrible.
I did watch one sidebar. I did watch one episode of Red Shoe Diaries, and it is really terrible.
It's just awful. Yeah. I mean, I'm not here to, like, you know, shit on another show, but I had to say that because
it's just the reality. But everyone should watch at least one episode because, you know, it's David, so you got to watch it. Just
really
give it a go.
Just to know what it is.
Just expect it not to be brilliant, but, you know, go into it embracing the cheesiness.
Embrace the cheesiness. And okay, first of all, we need to discuss the fact that Scully's biggest fear is clearly losing Mulder's trust or just losing trust in Mulder. Like, that is so cute. I mean,
adorable. Love that. It's my favorite part of this episode is the fact that we find out that Scully's deepest fear, the thing that triggers her, is being betrayed by Mulder. It's all about Mulder. It makes me so sad and happy and angsty and squee all at the same time.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I love the fact that it's the exact same thing that happened to Mulder when he was influenced by the psychotic water stuff in Anasazi.
Mm-hmm.
When he went nutso. And he was starting to think that Scully was turning on him. So that's obvious. There's like a parallel there that when they're under a psychotic influence that makes them paranoid, the first fear that comes to their mind is that they will be betrayed by the other because the trust that they have in each other is like the most important thing in their lives. And to lose that is the greatest loss either of them can imagine.
We're jumping all over, which is fine, but like, and then that sort of comes full circle at the end when he tells her that she's the only one he trusts. It's like he knows what do I have to tell you to get you to believe me, you know what I mean? And I think that's lovely, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to that, but I wanted to
talk about quickly the performances of David and Jillian throughout this episode, because I think Jillian, she's almost got more to work with here because she's doing something different. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that she does this sort of slow build to paranoia, like she kind of turns from concern to unhinged, like over the course of the episode, is really, really great. But I think yet again, Duchovny doesn't get enough credit for what he is doing because he has to play this very fine line between sort of appearing shady to Scully, like we can see that, but also being completely innocent. Like we could see it both ways. And I think he does that so subtly that you don't even notice that he's doing it. And I think, and because he's just being himself mostly, we don't notice and we're not supposed to notice. But I think, yet again, even though Jillian had more to chew on in this and she did a fantastic job, I just feel like David is really good at just doing what he's there to do brilliantly. And he had to do, it was hard. Like some of the lines that he had to deliver would be just something like, oh my God, is she right? Like, is he being shady or is like, I was kind of amazed at the way he did some of those deliveries that I don't think he normally would have done that. So
yeah,
I liked it. I liked it. They were both so good in this.
That's a really, really great point. that, yeah, during that period of time when Scully is starting to get suspicious before, you know, she starts shooting at people, there is that period when she's still working with Mulder. Mm-hmm. And you're right. David just very subtly infuses his performance with, not necessarily, you know, he doesn't seem sinister, but he seems like a little uncertain sometimes or something like that. He doesn't sound quite as, you know, definitive as sometimes he does. It's perfectly done. Mm-hmm. And you're right that I think it's kind of important for us to see things from Scully's perspective at that point. And to sort of, it's interesting. It's not like a bad blood thing where it's all from her perspective and it's not how Mulder was actually acting. That is how Mulder was acting.
No, it is how he's acting. But we are now, we're sort of on her side. I'm not pitting them against each other, but like we're seeing this from her point of view and we can see it. We can see it her way because if we can't see it her way, then there are no stakes. Like we know that something's happening to her and there's nothing wrong with Mulder, but like we have to believe that even for like 10 minutes or however long Scully believes it, we have to believe that maybe something's going on and maybe Mulder, like we see Mulder in that car with the smoking man. Like we see that with Scully.
We do.
And we're like, wait, is she hallucinating or is this really happening? What's going on? And like you say, like the placement of this episode right at the end of the season before the finale gives it some extra weight. Like you're watching it and you're thinking, oh my God, like, is there going to be a huge turn here? Like, is there like a, you know, like, and so it's possible. And I feel like they both, with their performances, make it feel possible where it very easily could have just been like, oh, well, clearly Scully is just going crazy. But you don't really think that. You think, well, this is Scully. She's clearly got a reason to think this is messed up. Like, and I feel like it's just, it's very wonderfully.
Yeah, it's
built and directed and acted and written, all of everything coming together in those moments that make this really good. And the music too, shout out to Mark Snow, because that that weird like brrr, like that little riff like I can't think of this episode without thinking of those weird little whatever that little instrument is or keyboard
whatever that is.
It's just so very, very specifically Wet Wired. Like I don't think that it's any other episode. I don't think he does that.
You're right. I was thinking the same thing. I was like, man, this scene would be nothing without Mark Snow. It would just seem kind of weird. So those are all really, really excellent points about how everything comes together to make it work so that it's kind of on two levels at that point where is Scully just totally crazy or is there a chance she could be right? I like the fact that it's still kept sort of ambiguous that you could believe either way for, you know, a good portion in the middle there. And it's just really, really, that's really tricky to pull off. And then to be able to go back and watch it knowing that it's not true, that Scully's wrong. And, but yet for Mulder's behavior to still seem so totally sort of believable, like, he's not at all odd here. He's just being Mulder. And I can kind of see he actually is just being Mulder. So it really genuinely does work both ways. Yep. And I mean, the X-Files does that so well, that just sort of putting out two theories and running them in parallel. And this is a great example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it just amazes me. It's like David actually had to put some work in here and it just kind of goes unnoticed. Yeah. So I wanted to point that out.
You're absolutely right. That's a really great point.
Well, thank you. I have to talk about something. I know I told you earlier that Vince Gilligan was going to come up and Breaking Bad might come up. Okay. So you aren't going to know this reference because you have not watched Better Call Saul yet, even though I know that's next on your agenda.
Correct.
But
it is.
There is a weird coincidence. Okay. This little Hummel figure, like the little traveler or whatever it is that they're talking about, this exact same figurine is in an episode of Better Call Saul. And
no way!
The title of the episode is even Alpine Shepherd Boy, because this particular little this figurine is like a pivotal thing in the episode, right?
Wow.
I remember when I watched Better Call Saul thinking, that was in Wet Wired. And this is how crazy of a person I am, like, because I remembered this weird, I remember Mulder picking it up and making a comment about it and saying, like, what was his comment? I don't remember what he said.
A thing of beauty is a joy
forever. Yes, like kind of making fun of how silly it is. But, like, they really linger on that figure. Like, you see it. You don't forget that it's like this little happy traveling Alpine boy.
Yeah, and it is. It is central to the scene.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with Hummels in terms of collector items. I think my mom probably collected these, or my grandma or somebody. But, like, there's got to be hundreds of them, right? And so for them to have picked that particular one for that episode made me think, is that a shout out to the X-Files? And I mean, we may never know, but I think that's also why in my mind I always think that Vince wrote this, because I think that it's Vince has some weird thing with the little shepherd boy. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get that it.
That is very interesting.
Wild, right? Like, what a weird coincidence. And I have I took a screenshot of it in Better Call Saul that I'll have to show you, or maybe we'll have to tweet out. But, like, it's just really random, and I had to bring it up.
Yeah, no, I can't believe that is a coincidence, because I agree that those figurines are, there's like a lot of different kinds, and I can't believe that one is so well known, unless I'm missing something. Maybe one of the collectors out there knows something about this one. But it seems, if it is a coincidence, it seems like a very big one.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it strikes me as it's something that maybe Vince has close to his heart or something, and like he helped out maybe on this episode, or maybe he was like, use this. I don't know. Like, he doesn't have to have a writer's credit to be like, here, use this. It'll be funny, and then Mulder can make fun of it. And I don't know. I like to believe
maybe he wrote that scene. Interestingly enough, we get a little a John Gilnitz shout out in this episode.
John Gilnitz.
That's the name of the neighbor of the woman who thought she was murdering her husband. The victim's name is John Gilnitz, which I think probably most X-Files viewers know is a combination of John Scheiben, Vince Gilligan, and Frank Spotnitz. And they often wrote together, those three. And so John Gilnitz shows up a couple of times on episodes of the X-Files, but usually on episodes that they have
wrote.
Written.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little, I wonder if that's like a little hint that those three guys did have a hand in this script, which might be why I love it so much.
It could totally be
a hint, I think, that maybe, and then this shepherd boy, the
this
little traveler.
Damn shepherd boy. Yeah, it's
there's got to be something going on there.
Yeah, I had to point it out. I'm sure other people have noticed this too. Anyone who kind of has watched both or all of Vince's shows in this and like probably have noticed it, but I noticed it.
I love it. I guess it feels to me like there's a Vince Gilligan universe.
Yeah.
And certain things show up in that universe. Yep. I mean, you sort of tipped me off that there were a few things on Breaking Bad that were from the X-Files, like lariat rental cars, a Marine Craddock Bank, and things like that. So Morley cigarettes.
Yeah.
So that's the Vince Gilligan universe, and these things exist in it. Sometimes they show up on the X-Files, and sometimes they show up on Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul. So
I just love it
because
it just makes me think they're just little nods to each other, which just makes me
happy. I love it.
Yeah.
I love that.
So Mulder is worried about Scully, and obviously because I'm trying to remember. He's trying to call her. He knows she's acting weird, and she keeps doing like the, what's that? What's that on the phone?
Yeah.
And he's probably like
after he goes to see the gunman the first time, he's calling her on the way back, and she's starting to become super paranoid at that point, because she's all like, I checked up on you with Agent Fennell you did not show.
She's playing that like a jealous girlfriend. I wonder if Jillian kind of had that in mind in terms of how am I going to play this, because some of those lines come across. She's like, where were you? Who were you with? Like, it was just, it made me laugh, because I was like, yeah, that sounds like somebody.
Like, as soon as she answered the phone, she's right away like, where are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It has that jealous girlfriend vibe, doesn't it?
It totally is.
It's that kind of paranoia. So, yeah, she's already like, her paranoia is super amped up, because she feels like he lied to her about where he was. And then she thinks she hears the clicking on the line. And then, she's just off to the races from there.
Yeah.
But Mulder's kind of onto it when she's like going on like, what is that? He's picked up at that point, no sooner, which is a little surprising in a way, but that's the point when he figures out she's acting weird.
Yeah, I mean, it hadn't been happening for very long.
He
could tell something was up, but then he does outright, I think, ask her on the phone, like, are you okay? Like, I think he asks her something like that. And then when he goes back to meet her, that's when she blows the door out. And then he's like, no, that's not Scully. Scully wouldn't do that. Like, that's not. And I like the idea that, like, Skinner is treating this like any other agent that this would mm-hmm. happen to. And Mulder's trying to say, like, no, like, he knows her well enough to know that there's something wrong and that they need to treat this case differently. And I like that. Yeah. I like that he's able to sort of say that to Skinner, and Skinner sort of hears him. And I mm-hmm. also like that conversation he has with Maggie Scully mm-hmm. when he calls her up, and it's very sweet because he's, I think he thinks maybe she went there, right? Like,
yeah.
And he's like, it's interesting because immediately he knows, oh crap, well now I've worried her. Like, and he probably feels so bad. And I love the way he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to hang up on you. I will call you back as soon as I know something. I like that was like, it's kind of a nice moment of social propriety from Mulder there, which does he don't get very often. So you're well right. done, we Mulder. Well
bravo. Done. Scully's having a good influence.
And I think these are the things that Maggie Scully likes about Mulder and remembers, because I think he understands and knows how to treat the moms. Like, even his own mom, when she treats him terribly, for the most part, he's very sweet with her, and he's very kind because she's a mom. And I feel like he gets that. Like, and he's like, this is Scully's mom. Like, I can't just, like, ditch her, even though he does that with his mom, I guess, that. But he had, like, he had crazy shit in his head, so that's different. But, that's like, I just love how he is with her. I mean, you can sort of see why she likes him, I think.
Yeah. So. He's like, he's a very good son to her. Yes. It's just very, it's very adorable. And, you know, I always love Maggie and Mulder together. And I love how she calls him Fox. And it's just very sort of endearing. But yeah, you can see, like, right away, I just feel for poor Maggie Scully when she answers the phone and she knows right away there's trouble when it's Mulder on the other line. I mean, this is really not that long, let's remember, between Scully's abduction.
Yeah, and Melissa getting shot and all of that.
And Melissa getting shot. A lot has happened in a fairly short time. This is just the end of season three, and all that happened in season two and the start of three. So a lot has happened to poor Mrs. Scully during that period. And then it's like, oh my God,
it's like,
are
what
you serious?
Now?
Like this shit again? But she has this wonderful sort of gracious vibe about her where she's like, she knows this is there's trouble here, but she always keeps her shit together in sort of an impressive way. And I just love her. And she reacts in a very sort of believable way when Mulder calls her. It's exactly how you'd expect her to respond given what has happened in their recent history.
I like the fact too, and again we're going to keep going back and forth to this scene, but like later too, the when we get to the climactic scene when she doesn't understand what's going on. Like she's perfectly aware and respectful of the fact that like Mulder and Scully have this own world that she isn't going to ever be privy to all of the shit that they know and learn about and discover and have to cover up all that. But she respects it and she knows that they trust each other. And like she in this moment, sorry, again, I keep jumping. You can talk about it if you want. But like she trusts Mulder more than she trusts her own daughter in this moment she knows that there's something wrong. And I think that is so, that speaks volumes, like to maybe, you know, things that we haven't seen that between these characters or even just, you know, what's going on in Margaret Scully's head, like about their relationship and how they trust each other. And it's a really remarkable scene for that reason, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really great point. Just to that specific point about that scene where I get the impression from the dialogue in the scene that Scully knows it's Mulder at the door and has told her mother not to let him in specifically. Yeah. And perhaps has told her that he's here to kill me.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like to Maggie Scully's credit and the credit of the relationship she has with Mulder, that she doesn't hesitate. She doesn't believe for a second that Scully is telling the truth. Obviously, she knows her daughter well enough also to know that she's a little unhinged. But even then, you know, a lot of moms would still be like, well, maybe she's telling the truth about this part. But she knows Mulder well enough to know that's just not going to happen.
And I think she even knows that at the door when she's not letting him in. And I think in her mind, she's like, I just don't want shit to go down. Like, I think she's trying to mediate. She's like, I know that Mulder's not going to come in here to kill Scully. Like, she's not there thinking I'm protecting my daughter from you. Not at all. Yeah. I think she's just there thinking I don't want trouble. Like, yeah. I just kind of want to let this whole thing settle down.
Yeah. And I almost get the impression she's protecting Mulder because she knows that, you know, Scully is that unhinged and who knows how much she's been waving that gun around. And so she might be thinking, I need to get Mulder out of here or she might shoot him. So I think that that makes total sense. And she really conveys that well. And Sheila Larkin conveys that well in that brief conversation at the door.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll get back to that. Of course we will. And I love that we keep bringing up different things about it because otherwise we would probably talk about it for 20 minutes later.
It's good, though.
Yeah. So let's talk about the scene at the gunman when they are talking about what's actually causing this. We have to talk about the red-green colorblind thing, right? Like,
yes, we do.
I think, and we've discussed this on the pod before. If people have listened to all of our episodes, they've heard us talk about this before. But like, there is a callback to this in the revival, and we've said this before. Mm-hmm. When they're in Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, when they're gonna eat the Jell-O at the end, and he's like, I don't want to. Maybe it's the lemon lime, and that's totally a throwback to this. I have to say that it's even hard for me to consider it canon, but at the same time, I just so rarely think about it, and it doesn't really affect the story for me that it kind of doesn't matter, other than the fact that a lot of people have made a really good point of like, how would he pass his eye exams and his firearms test and all these things and I know that red-green colorblind, I'm sure is you're perfectly capable of completing those tasks. It's not like you can't see. I don't know what the actual tests consists of. Yeah, I don't know if this is possible.
Yeah, I think they would probably test for that. I mean, I know that when I went for my driver's test, they gave me one of the tests they gave me seemed to be testing for color blindness because it's kind of like, can you see this number amongst all these colored dots?
Right, yeah.
So it seems like they are. I mean, just to get a driver's license, it seems like being colorblind comes into it.
Yeah.
It's a green light, I suppose.
I think red-green colorblind is kind of a strange misnomer because it doesn't necessarily mean you don't see red and you don't see green. Like if you Google it, you can actually see the difference of what red-green colorblind people see. And it's not remarkably different from what we see. It's just like, instead of red, it's kind of more brown. And instead of green, it's kind of slightly more brown. Like it's not quite, they're just not quite as vibrant as we would see them. And even talking about this is so weird because it's like, when you really think about it, none of us really know if what we're seeing is the same. And
who knows, right?
That is a whole new conversation and a fascinating one.
You're blowing my mind right now.
That's going to keep you awake tonight. But
it kind of is. Like, is red what I think it is?
Yeah. Is red really red? Because how am I supposed to explain
to you?
How would
we know?
We wouldn't know.
It's just red.
But, I mean, according to Google.
Yeah. Okay.
Somehow,
thank you, Google.
This is not anything related. Maybe I've talked about this before, but somehow they're able to make those Harry Potter jelly beans taste like vomit. And apparently everybody's vomit tastes the same.
That. Yeah.
Did we talk about this? Because maybe we were talking about something disgusting and I brought this up, but
we were talking about like the 10 grossest moments. And so the concept of vomit came up.
Maybe that's what we were talking about. But like just the idea that like people would know what vomit tastes like and they actually had to compare this and taste test. Like,
why are we talking about this
again? I don't
again?
Know, but like it was one of those things that's like, that's not anything I would ever want to know. Like, I wouldn't want to know if things taste the same like that to me as you. But like, again, that's something I suppose you could test. Whereas this is something, how would you test that? Like, how would you?
Yeah, it would be tricky.
That was quite a tangent. I apologize. I don't want to bring up
vomit.
Yeah,
no, it was interesting.
I'm continually amazed by those vomit jelly beans. I don't know why anyone would invent such a thing. It's disgusting, but
anyway, it's always really interesting to hear about the vomit jelly beans. Interesting and disgusting.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
But people give this episode a lot of grief for this red-green colorblind thing.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Because it's like, okay, we had to do this just for the plot to work in this particular episode. Whereas it could have pretty easily explained away. Like, maybe Mulder was supposed to be watching the tapes and he turned on the game instead. Like, I don't know. They could have explained it away another way, but
they very easily could.
Yeah. So, I mean, I get it. It's kind of it's an annoying thing to affect his character forever for just this episode. Yeah. But at the same time, like I said, I don't really think about it. It doesn't really bother me. So
no.
Whatever.
Yeah. Honestly, it's kind of like Mulder's phobia of fire in Fire. That it's one of those things, like it came in handy for the episode, but I get it. You know, not everything is always going to be, you know, brilliantly written, and it's okay. I'll give you a pass that you wanted to include for this episode, but I agree with you that it wasn't necessary.
Yeah, like, they could have explained it away.
We see Scully watching way more of the tapes than Mulder did. Yeah. That in itself could have been an explanation.
Could have been
we
enough.
Know she watched more than he did.
Yeah.
So that could have been enough, you know, just play that up a little bit more. And that alone could have done it. So, but, you know, they wanted to bring in the red, green colorblind thing. And what are we to make of the fact that Mulder is holding up his tie?
I was going to ask
when
you
he
about
refers
that.
To the when he refers to the colorblindness.
Is that him sort of just like justifying his horribly atrocious tie choices?
That seems to be it.
Look at my tie, guys. Obviously, I can't see straight. Like,
yeah, look at my tie, for God's sake, which ironically enough is not a bad tie in this episode. But
no. Yeah,
I got to think that was like maybe a David Duchovny thing. He must be well aware of the ugliness of his ties. And he's like, oh, good. Now I can
now I have an excuse.
There's an explanation for my ties, because I can't believe that was written in the script. He holds up his tie because why would he? Yeah, I got to think that David just threw that in there. And that's the only thing that makes sense to me, because he very, very clearly does it. It's not like, it's not something that's subtle. It's right there.
Yeah.
He's holding his tie
while
he's announcing that he's colorblind. So I got to think that's it.
Yeah, I just think that's funny. It's totally like a knock at the wardrobe department. Like, come on, guys.
It really is. And I can kind of see where he's coming from.
So the scene where he goes to see Scully in the morgue, or he thinks that he's going to see. Wow. Like this whole scene.
My heart is broken.
Him kind of in the car, them giving him that extra beat to just sort of sit in the car, like preparing to go inside, is so powerful. So good. I like this scene where he's like giving no shits about this guy again. He's like, you know, I don't even care. Like I think it's very Mulder the way he's acting around this guy, and the way he's very one track mind, especially if Scully is in peril, that's going to be where he goes. The guilt he must feel too, because it's like he showed up in this middle of this night rendezvous with this no name person, and now Scully could be dead. Like, you know, Mulder must go through this so often that I feel so bad for him. But I did want to point out in this scene, there's a really great Rob Bowman thing where it's like you see him walking into the hallway. You know what I'm talking about? He looks up at the ceiling, and then it kind of cuts to the hallway, but it's like spinning, and then it kind of goes down. It's such a great, and
it's totally from Mulder's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's giving you this sort of feeling of like, I'm not quite grounded. I can't be fully viable, like physically here until I know that she's okay. It's a really great choice. And I thought, I don't think I ever really noticed it or picked up on it before. But since, you know, like you said, when we're watching this critically, we notice these things. But it was just a really great directorial decision. Love it.
I noticed the exact same thing, and it was the first time I also noticed it, and I love it. I had to watch it like three times over. I loved it so much. And you're right. It gives a sense of almost like almost a little touch of vertigo or like unreality, like this isn't happening right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing the corner at the end of the hallway from this whole thing is clearly Mulder's direct point of view. We're seeing what he's seeing. And yeah, it's amazing the way it's done and the way it's edited as well, where he just glances up and then we cut to that shot.
Yeah. I had to back it up a couple times. Yeah. Cause I was like, wait, I got to watch this again. Cause this was so cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love
that. You noticed that.
And it's one of those things that, like, it's very cool, but it serves the narrative. Mm-hmm. It sort of tells us, gives us some insight into how Mulder's feeling at that moment,
Like, it's purposeful.
Which is so great.
It's not just done for the sake of being fancy. Like, it's definitely there for a reason.
But it is fancy. So I do like that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Dave, you're right. David Duchovny is so amazing through this whole segment. Even going back to the end of the previous scene when he's telling the gunman that, you know, they think they, you know, they want me to go identify the body. He's so, you know, you can just hear he's heartbroken, but it's done so subtly, as he always does.
Mm-hmm.
And everything through that scene is just brilliant the way he plays it.
And he tries to, he's trying to hold it together because he has to. But I mean, and how long he looks at her before saying mm-hmm. it's not her. It's a long time. I want to say it's like...
It's a long time.
I want to say it's like 5 seconds or something before he says it's not her, because we're just sitting here waiting. Like, he's seeing it, but we're waiting. Like, clearly he knows right away, but he is processing that. Like, how close did I come to this being Scully? And I do like that
it's like he can't speak at first. Like, no. He just needs to like get himself together before he can even say it.
Yeah. And I do like that his first thought is we need to call her mother, because it's just, again, it shows like that part of Mulder that is not, it's not always entirely selfish. He's thinking of her. He wants to make sure that like her mom knows, because she's worried. Like, clearly he knows she's worried. And I like the idea that he knows if she's not answering her phone, something's wrong. Like, he immediately knows, he clues into that, and he heads right over there.
And that was good. I mean, you know, it worked as a plot point for him to ask about Scully's mother, but it was, you're absolutely right, from a character perspective, it works really well too. And that's just very neatly written, where that leads into him knowing exactly where Scully is. And it's totally believable in terms of writing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, here's this scene. I mean, let's talk about it. He shows up.
Yes.
Maggie is very clearly shaken. I mean, we can tell. Mulder can tell. And she's not the best of actors, but, you know, she doesn't have to be. And she's telling him to, like, you know, please don't come in. Don't, like, go away. Like, just because I think, again, she's just trying to protect them both. She knows some shit's going to go down. And I do love that she immediately steps in front of Mulder. Because, I mean, it's interesting, because she can see Scully, she can see her daughter through this crazy. And she knows mm-hmm. that, like, Scully can see her, too, just because of some of the ways Jillian delivered those lines. Like, she's like, come on, mom, like, get out of the way. Like,
get out of the way.
Get out of the way, mom. Like, and you can hear Scully in there. Like, she's in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think Maggie picks up on that. And I love that little moment where she just... no fear. She just kind of just steps in front. And I think that's really brilliant.
So great. I mean, the connection between Scully and her mom in that scene is amazing. And it's interesting that the way that the scene works out, it is Maggie that kind of brings Scully out of it in the end, you know, with, you know, her, you know, infallible logic, you know, if you trust me, right. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that you're wrong and that Mulder's okay. And, like, you know, that's what gets through to Scully.
Yeah.
Some part of me always kind of wishes it was Mulder that had kind of snapped her out of it. Cause it's like, chipper.
Yeah.
But it's very sweet that it's Maggie, that's the depth and strength of their relationship. And I love that, actually.
Yeah. And I think that as well as Mulder knows Scully, Maggie knows her better, I think.
Yeah.
At least at this stage. And she knows exactly, like you said, what's going to get through to her. I know mm-hmm. what to say that's going to get through to her. And it's clear to Maggie, too, in this moment, that she is the one who's trusted. Like, clearly Scully's not going to shoot at her. Scully trusts her. And so Maggie's like, I know how to get her at least to put the gun down. Like, and if we can get the gun to go down, then maybe we can talk and hammer this out. It always kills me that the scene cuts off where it does, because I would love to see the last part of this scene. If anyone has ever written a fic about that, let me know. I want to read it.
Yeah, it does end just a little earlier than I would like.
Yeah, it does. But it is a really, it's a good place to end the scene. It's just one of those things where I'm just like, oh, I wish I could see the aftermath of this. Like, what happened?
I mean, because everything is so interesting and awesome up until that point. I just want to see more of it.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Give me more.
It's really, one of those really great scenes that you want more of.
It's just so brilliant. All three actors are amazing in it. You know, Jillian, David, and Sheila, they're so amazing. Yeah. And it's brilliantly written. And I'm always really interested in the things that Scully is saying, because I think there's kind of an implication. Well, they actually say in the episode that the things that the people come to fear are the things that they fear the most. And we've discussed this already about how Scully's fear is Mulder betraying her. But it's interesting how she specifically brings up things like her abduction, the chip, Melissa's murder. And what it says to me from a character perspective is that these things, even though she rarely talks about them and doesn't seem to be affected by them, those things are always just below the surface for Scully. So when something like this happens, you know, it all comes out to the surface. You know, her usual sort of barriers are gone, and we hear that kind of deep-seated fear that she has over these things that have happened to her. And so it's interesting to hear her mentioning those and what it says about what Scully's like all the time. You know, she's probably always traumatized by these things, but just rarely, you know, would allow herself to talk about them. So
exactly.
I love that. I love the language that she's using, you know, saying to her mom, you know, he's lied to me from the beginning. It reminds me of Anasazi, where Mulder said, you know, right from, you know, from the beginning, you were always taking your little notes.
Yeah.
And it made me think of that. There's just such a parallel. Mm-hmm. And Mulder says, I'm on your side. You know that. And I think that Scully says the exact same thing in Anasazi. Yeah. I'm on your side. You know that. Yeah. She says
when
the exact
she's trying
same
to
thing.
Like get the bullet cleared through ballistics or
exactly.
something. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. When Mulder wakes up in her bed in the morning and, it's, you know, Scully says, Mulder, you're sick. You're not thinking straight. I'm on your side. You know that. And, you know, Mulder says almost something exactly the same. I'm on your side. You know that.
You don't know
you
this,
don't know
but
it,
you're sick.
But you're sick. And so I find that really interesting, that parallel of they're kind of experiencing that she's experiencing the same thing he did.
Yeah.
And she's experiencing exactly the same way because, you know, that's, they're in that relationship in the same way for each other. And so it affects them the same way that when they have a little breakdown, it happens exactly the same way because they care and feel the same way about each other. And it's very heartbreaking to of see Scully go through that. And for Mulder to have to hear that stuff. But, you know, he keeps his cool and he lets Maggie take control. He knows that that's the right strategy here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not going to be all macho and have to be in charge. He's willing to stand back and let Maggie resolve this.
Right.
And which turns out to be the right move, of course. And I just love everything about it.
Sorry, Eric's making a ton of noise. Hang on. Go ahead and mark this because
I am.
Okay. Sorry about that. I was just kind of like about to mute it, but then you stopped talking. So the timing was very poor.
I could have gone on for a while longer.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Sorry about that. I was going to say, another thing that I really liked about this scene was I really liked Jillian's delivery of when she's like, just step back. And she kind of like clicks her.
The
gun. I don't know what the term is. I don't know guns. But like, it's such a great delivery and it's scary. Like, I would be scared too. I would step back.
Yeah. We already know she's fired the gun earlier in the episode. She's perfectly capable of actually shooting someone at that point.
Yeah, totally. And he knows that. And I think he's totally knows, but like, he's trying to talk her down. I do love the idea that he said that to Skinner earlier. It's like, I think she'll talk to me. I think she'll talk to me. And we're like, little did we know. Maggie was the one she needed, which
Maggie was the key.
Still, I loved that. It was such a cool scene.
Beautiful. I mean, I love scenes with the three of them together. So it's always dynamite. And even when Maggie was lying there dying in Home Again in the revival, the three of them were still awesome together.
It still worked because the three of them together, I mean, it's just there's magic chemistry there. It is true.
Always good. Always good.
Okay, so let's move into this next scene when we think the episode's over, but no, there's 10 more minutes. So they have a nice little scene in the hospital. I love when Mulder walks in and he kind of like puts his hands up. I just think that's so cute.
Yeah.
And I wonder
Mulder, come on now. Don't rub it in.
No, but I love that because he's just playing around with her. Like she is kind of like, quote unquote, embarrassed. But like, I do think that that's cute. And I think that's
it's
him.
Good,
it's him. He's trying to lighten the mood, I think.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was an ad lib. I'm curious if that was in the script because it kind of.
I got to kind of. Yeah, it does feel a bit like an ad lib.
Feels like
it?
Something David would do. So I was just curious about that. Yeah. I wanted to say.
I love the fact that is the second. I was just going to say this. I love the fact that the second Mulder walks in, Maggie's like, hi, Fox, I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. Time
she
to
always
leave
knows
them.
It's like, yeah, time to leave the two lovebirds alone.
Yeah, she's like, oh, I'm going to make myself scarce. Yeah, no, yeah. She's like the smartest cute. Character on the show, I'm convinced.
She really is.
So I wanted to point out that they cast a female doctor, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah,
anytime they do like that. Yeah, and I thought this character was really good. I like the conversation that she has with Mulder, and it all felt very believable. Like, this is a conversation that an FBI agent and a doctor would have with each other, and it just was a really nice little scene. And I feel like it got across information to me that I maybe didn't really take into account, which was like the actual physiological impact that it would have on, like, you know, the different levels of, you know, whatever you call all this. I don't know what I'm talking about, but you know what I mean, like, in your actual brain.
It's okay.
The levels of that stuff, like, what the serotonin levels and
she was saying it was like, yeah, she had like this really sort of high serotonin level, which honestly, I mean, not totally sure that this like subliminal thing that's supposed to signal something in your brain, maybe it can create serotonin. First thing I thought was, please, may I have access to that? We'll never need antidepressants again. No. We'll just watch this and the serotonin will naturally rise. Can I get me some of that?
But it's
I don't think there's any actual, and I don't think there's any such thing that actually raises your serotonin, or that super high serotonin even, I mean, she says, you know, it can cause mania. From my limited Google research, I think that elevated serotonin can make you like anxious and like irritable and a bit confused. But I mean, the idea of having like full on delusions of where you're murdering people, I'm not so sure. But, you know, who knows? Maybe back in the 90s, that's what they thought.
Well, and also it is the X-Files, so anything is possible. So
it's the X-Files. It's like we're not going to worry too much about the details. But I do want some of those like color rays coming at me. Like, bring me the serotonin.
Yeah,
I could use it.
It sounds good. So let's take it. I have to ask you, Jen, because as many times as I've seen Wet Wired, and I've seen it many times, I still have no idea how Mulder makes this next connection and how he gets from A to B to C and gets to the motel. Every time I watch it and I'm confused. Do you know what?
All right,
like, he calls to try and talk to the doctor.
He wants to, he immediately suspects the doctor because the real doctor, the lady doctor, has clarified that what the previous doctor said can't possibly have been true. And so he immediately thinks, okay, that guy.
Okay, that's what I didn't make the connection. Because did the guy at the beginning say the thing about the amphetamines?
Yeah, I think he did.
Okay, and see, that happened so long ago in the episode that I totally forgot about it.
Yeah.
So much stuff happened that I did not make that connection. So if I had written this episode, I would have had Mulder will say, a previous doctor, when we were first discussing this case, the previous doctor said the blah, 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 blah. I would have reminded us, because like I said, I've seen this episode a million times, and every single time I'm like, what the fuck? How did he get from that to this random ass doctor that we haven't seen in 40 minutes? Like, I had no idea. And then how he got from that to making the call, and he's like, oh, he's away at DC, to suddenly assuming he's shady, which now that makes sense if he lied to him, which I didn't know. But then he immediately pulls out the motel matchbook. What, on a hunch? Like,
yeah, like his hunch is he was staying at the motel. I mean, staying at the motel.
Why was he so sure about that? Like, okay, these were two, in my mind, incredibly weird hunches that he just kind of came up with out of whole cloth. And every time I watch it, I'm like, what the fuck, Mulder? Like, what did we miss a scene? Like, I did not get it. I still don't know how he associates that motel and matchbook with the doctor. No idea.
There are a few moments, I think, in this episode where there are some plot leaps that are very convenient.
Yeah.
And this is one
annoying.
Of them.
Yeah.
Where like I kind of get the doctor thing, although, you know, you could just think that he was not a great doctor and it made the wrong diagnosis.
Yeah, exactly.
That happens. But, you know, okay, you figured out that the doctor, you assume he was lying to you. And But I don't know why he would for a second think he was staying at the same motel that they were staying at. Because
I have nothing. I got nothing, Jen.
He doesn't have to have been staying there.
There have to be more motels in this town, right? Like,
yeah. And there's no reason for him to even have really been right where they were necessarily, because the cable guy was actually doing the actual sort of technical stuff of setting up these signals. And so Dr. Guy didn't necessarily have to be right in that motel unless, I don't know, maybe he was supposedly following them, but you'd think that they would have noticed him if that was the case. So
it's just
I have
weird.
No idea.
It's bizarre.
For some reason, we need to kind of get Mulder back to the motel so we can get the call records, so we can figure out, you know, where they're meeting or something like that.
But why couldn't he have just gotten those from the lady that he called? This is what I'm talking about. Like, unnecessary stuff that makes it more confusing than it has to be. And I mean, don't get me wrong.
There's just too many layers.
Yeah, I love the motel guy. He's fun. He should have his own spinoff. I like that guy. I like the scene with the motel manager guy. He's fun. But like, we don't need that scene. That was like 2 minutes of scene we didn't need. And again, this could propel us more quickly towards the end of the episode and not have this long, annoying gap. Like, he does find the cigarettes there, right? Doesn't he find the cigarettes or something? I don't remember.
Maybe he does find a cigarette there.
So maybe he does have to go to the motel. But anyway,
I guess he has to. But I don't know. I mean, I would have been okay if he hadn't found the cigarette. I still would have been okay with him thinking the guy was suspicious enough to follow up on.
Yeah.
And all he had to do was get a record of that guy calling this number that turned out to be this host that he goes to.
Yeah.
And there was lots of different ways they could have done that without him having to have been staying at the same motel as them. So
Especially,
I don't know, maybe they were just trying to cheap out on sets or something. It's like, we have the motel set, let's use that one again. I mean, they could have gotten that call information from anywhere. He could have been he was staying at such and such a place, or maybe he got his call records from the hospital, from his office or something like that.
Yeah,
there's lots of ways you could have done that.
They could have done it a lot of ways. I mean, I feel like this is one of those cases of they were trying to make something more believable, but ended up making it less. Like, they were trying to make it more cohesive and fit together, but in the end, it just feels less authentic.
Yeah. Yeah, at the time it felt like it meant something, like, oh my God, it's their motel. But in the end, that doesn't actually matter.
No,
so,
it doesn't.
Yeah, it's a little strange. And that, along with, I would say, in terms of sort of like convenience, in terms of plot, you know, always just happening to see the cable guy when they're on these crime scenes was very convenient too.
Yeah.
At first I thought, well, it's not a coincidence because he's there removing the device because the crime has been committed. But then I realized, no, he's putting the device in because when Mulder goes and climbs up the thing to find the cable thing,
it's there.
It's a new device that's just been put in. So it seems to be a coincidence that they happen to have seen him install this device while they were at the crime scene.
Well, and I mean, they also didn't need two guys. Like, it could have just been the doctor guy dressed up like the cable guy. It's the same guy.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they needed to have, they had the two guys, but they could have just had one guy doing it, couldn't they?
They could have had one guy doing it. I mean, look, you also, if you're going to have two guys, then you do not need the doctor staying at the same freaking motel. That's like pretty sloppy bad guy work. Like, that's like bad guy 101. You don't want to like hang out near the scene of the crime if you're,
honestly,
your henchman is doing
exactly.
shit.
It's There's just, no need to be there.
We are really nitpicking this, Jen, but you know what? That's what we're here for.
Yeah, I mean, Mulder and Scully could so easily have seen him while he was staying at that motel. All he had to do was nip out for ice, and the game would have been up right and there.
This is just, it was just very poor planning for this insanely important government scheme to be happening right beneath their noses.
Really,
like this.
Yeah. But you mean, like, for as much as those plot points are clearly a little bit weak, maybe someone who's just watching this and strictly interested in plot points would find it troublesome enough that they would lower the rating of this episode. Like, when I was looking on the Wikipedia page, I noticed that sort of the critics at the time sort of liked but didn't love this episode, apparently. Mm-hmm. And it was largely because of these sort of slightly weak points in the plot.
Yeah.
But honestly, does not matter to me. It's yeah. like, I mean, I recognize them and they're kind of funny to me in a way, but it does nothing to lessen my love of the episode.
It's interesting because I wouldn't say it does nothing because for me and like my sort of like OCD-ness, I'm kind of like, oh, it could have been a perfect episode. And so
yeah.
it bums yeah. me out when dumb shit like this kind of takes away from an otherwise perfect episode.
Yeah.
So that bothers me about yeah. it. But overall, yeah, whatever. I Fair. Can forgive it as just sloppy yeah. plotting. But...
And it was, and these, and a lot of this was so easily resolved. Yeah. They didn't have to take the route that they took. So that is a little irksome.
It's, yeah, it's one of these that it feels like it was like, maybe it was rewritten a lot and just not, not necessarily rewritten as solidly as it could have been. I don't know.
Yeah. And they may have had to do some last minute rewrites on it. And this was just, you know.
Yeah.
This we have to go with what we got. And maybe it's something that came out in editing, too. Who knows?
I'm glad you were just as confused about that bit as me, though, because every time I watch it, I yeah. think, maybe this is going to make sense this time. And then every time I'm like, nope.
It still anyway. Doesn't. It never will.
It never will. I think I really don't have a whole lot more to say. I mean, we should talk about the scene with X, obviously. Like, I think... this is a really cool scene. And we don't have much more time with X. So it's like every time that we see him now is mm-hmm. like, it's more and more weighty.
Yeah.
Like it's more and more important. But
yeah,
what is your take on sort of X, what he says to Mulder? Like, I get Mulder's frustration, but at the same time, I totally get what X is saying too. Like, he can't be the one to mm-hmm. whistleblow this. Like,
yeah,
because then he's, done this stuff is going to go on forever and
yeah
he needs to be there shedding the light for others to figure it out. Like, that's his role. And I mean,
yeah,
Mulder is being slightly you know, tantrumy here mm-hmm. and with good reason, because he nearly got killed and Scully nearly got killed, and I mean, it is what they signed up for. I understand, but at the same time, he's like, come on, man, like, you got to give me more. Like, you shot these guys 3 seconds before I walked into the house. Like, you couldn't have just, like, waited? Like, come on. It was just like, and yeah. it does seem to Mulder, from Mulder's perspective, like he's being toyed with. And so I can see that from Mulder's POV. But I also really kind of can empathize, not empathize. I can't empathize with X, but I can sympathize with X. I can see X. Yeah. I can see his perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the reality is that this is how all of Mulder's informants treat him. You know, this is he never really had this conversation with Deep Throat, for example, and he could have.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of put it down to the fact that he's just coming off of this situation where Scully was in danger and could have died. And yeah. I think he's, you know, the whole experience of having to go to the coroner's office and all that. That was really hard on him, I think, and he's not over that. And so I think that he's maybe just a little more agitated than he would normally be. And probably he kind of gets over this soon after. I think he's feeling pretty riled up at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not wrong in the points that he makes, but again, all of his informants have this issue. And yeah, they wouldn't be much use as informants if they came out from the shadows and started doing these things for themselves. They have to get him to do it. It's the only way that it works.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's a great scene. It's a very tense scene. Stephen Williams is fantastic in it, as always. But I can kind of see both of their points of view. But they're, at the end of the day, I think that X is right, that there's no other way he can do this. And Mulder's coming from a place of emotion rather than rational thinking, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mulder does need him. And I think he realizes that he's right. Like, shooting him's not going to help anything. You know, yeah. it's not going to help anything.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's how he's feeling. He feels his feelings a lot, does Mulder, bless him. And so that's just his feelings coming out and triggered, I think, largely because of what happened to Scully. So it just, you know, throws him off a little bit, makes him a little bit overly emotional. But that's okay. That's our Mulder.
Right. And sorry, clearly Leia is very emotional about this scene, too. She's being very loud.
Yeah. Oh, she's got the feels, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah.
She knew that we were talking about that part, and she came mm. out.
It's her favorite part. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say, the last thing I wanted to say about this episode is this scene with, the very end scene with mm-hmm. CSM and X, because this is the first time we've seen these two characters together. It's like, up till now,
yeah.
I don't think we've seen X interacting with anyone from the syndicate, right?
Yeah, no, I don't think we have.
Because we've never seen him in the room with them. We've never really seen him taking orders from them. Like, I feel like this is the only time we see that or will see that.
Yep.
And it's a cool, cool scene for that reason. But I think William B. Davis is really good in this scene too, because he didn't have a whole lot to do, but it's reflective. I love the idea that they put them in a car. They didn't have to do that, but they put them in the car because it's a nice parallel for what we saw earlier with Mulder and Smoking Man in the car, which I thought was nice. But I also love the fact that that look that CSM gives X, it's like, you know, X is in trouble. And they really allow that, him to hold that look for several seconds and then kind of turn back, so that he's got such an easy power over anyone that he's in the scene with. I think he's so good.
Right.
And this is just a really good example of him, I think, really owning a scene, and he only needed one. You know what I mean? And I bet when you were watching this and he actually showed up at the end, because you thought that the first one would have been a hallucination or whatever, yada, yada, yada. But at the very end, when he actually shows up and you realize, yes, this whole thing has in fact been by Smoking Man, like yet again, it was probably very exciting.
It was really surprising because you know, there's plenty of times in the X-Files where there's just random conspiracies and we never really find out who's behind them, and that there's no indication it's necessarily going to be the syndicate. And I would have been totally fine with not finding out any more than we had. You know, obviously there'd be some implication of a syndicate involvement because of Mr. X's involvement, but who knows how much.
Right.
Certainly wouldn't have occurred to me that it was CSM. So yeah, it was definitely a surprise to see him at the end, and a delightful one at that, because you're right, it is kind of a very cool scene between the two of them. And definitely, yeah, we get the impression that X is in some trouble, which leads nicely into the next episodes.
Yeah. Well, this also reminds me of the, I think Eve in season one, when Deep Throat shows up to sort of help Mulder with that, but it doesn't necessarily come around and show a syndicate connection, even though we can, you know, infer, especially with the things that come later, that this probably was a syndicate experiment. You weren't seeing this coming because we have a precedent. Like, we already had this episode where, oh, well, they just come and they help him stop bad shit from happening. It doesn't necessarily mean it's stuff that Smoky Man is responsible for. But in this in this case, it was. And again, I think it wasn't necessary for this story. But I think because of some of the stuff, I guess, we were dealing with in terms of Scully's trust issues and all that, it is a nice little button at the end and a nice little shock that it was really him all along. So it was a good decision. I just think maybe an execution, as usual, could have been a little bit better in terms of just clarity.
Yeah, but you know, but it's always good to see CSM no matter what, so yeah, I was happy for that. But yeah, that the whole sort of like denouement after the scene with Maggie and Scully and Mulder does sort of drag on a bit. So, you know, we were talking about the pacing earlier, obviously we have issues with that. Maybe the solution just would have been to tighten it all up and somehow to sort of, because we've got quite a lot happening with X at the end, which probably has a lot to do with Stephen Williams' availability, because we didn't see him earlier in the episode. And then suddenly he's all over the episode.
Yeah.
He's in the house. He's with CSM. It almost feels like we're in a different episode all of a sudden.
Yeah, it feels disjointed. I feel like that's my main critique of this, just the way that it's kind of, and I don't know if it's a script issue or an editing issue, but just it doesn't flow quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Flows differently than a normal episode would. And that's a little distracting.
Yeah.
But just for the record, I mean, I've been hard on it tonight, but I was just out of curiosity looking up my ranking. And I have Wetwired at, it's my number 27. So it's very high.
I have it at 15.
Nice, nice.
And I looked at my list and noticed that apparently I hadn't had it on my previous top 25 list, but my most recent one from last year, it managed to get up to 15. And after watching this again last night, I almost was thinking I could definitely put it higher than that even. So Wetwire just keeps going up my list every time I watch it. There's just a lot to love about that episode for me, from especially David and Jillian, what they do, and Sheila Larkin. They're just really bringing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm loving the character stuff. I like the conspiracy stuff. It's cool. And there is a lot happening here. But, you know, I love episodes where there's just like all our favorite characters are here, because it so rarely happens that we have Skinner and the Lone Gunman and Maggie Scully and CSM and Mr. X all in the same episode. And the fact that it's a single episode and it's not even a mythology episode makes it very special.
It is so very special.
I love every aspect of that. And wigged out Scully is just quite fascinating to watch as well. So there's just a lot that I just really like about this episode. So I think if I were to do my rankings again, I think this would go up even a little bit higher. It's just a really great episode. And just one that I just love a lot. It just has a happy place in my heart.
Yeah. No, same. I think it's great. Well, do you have anything else to add about Wet Wired?
I don't think I do. I just sang its praises. And if you haven't watched Wet Wired in a while, because I think maybe it's maybe a little under the radar sometimes in terms of sort of high profile episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give it another watch, because there is a lot of great stuff happening in this episode. It is quite entertaining to watch, and there's a lot of great MSR stuff too. So give it a go, because it is a great episode for me.
And if you can explain how Mulder wanted, why the guy stayed at the motel, please tell us, because clearly we're baffled.
Why? Yeah, it just doesn't work.
Anyway, let us know if you're over on Twitter at XFD Podcast. We'd love to hear from you guys. And we will be back with you in a couple weeks with another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.